Hello and welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. So today we are joined by somebody who lives and breathes the word entrepreneur. Ex-founder who sold his business in a multi-million pound deal, who's now set up a premium co-working space in an 18th century chapel. Alongside all of this, he runs an accountability coaching business and a premium children's sleepwear brand. We're very lucky today to be joined by someone who is going to fill us with actionable takeaways to ignore that little voice in our head and make the leap and take more risks. Our guest today is Eddie Whittingham. Eddie, how are you?
I'm well, mate. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Are you well?
I'm well. I'm well. Thank you for joining us. So, Eddie, I'm going to ask you a big open question. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
I'm just a sort of normal, stereotypical working class lad, really. Grew up in Scunthorpe. I've sort of done various things, as I'm sure we'll sort of talk about during today's podcast. But really, my genuine passion is trying to help other people. So if I can push people to do better in whatever aspect they're doing, then so be it. And when I look at the sort of businesses that I have now, it's all kind of shaped towards that, really. So the sort of primary things that I'm involved in at the minute, I've just opened literally the fourth week now, co-working space in Manchester. So that's early days, but it's going really, really well. So that's quite exciting. I co-founded a baby grow business called Grow Grows, where we do premium sleepwear, sustainable sleepwear. And I also founded GoFounder, which is basically accountability coaching for founders. Typically, what we're seeing is those with ADHD or at least neurodivergent. We've sort of got a 70% sort of cut there, really, of people who need help there. So, yeah, it's quite interesting.
Okay. And so where does this, I guess, passion to help people come from? Like, what could you pinpoint it to? Like, why are you so passionate about that?
Probably just upbringing, really. Like I say, working class background, not from privilege, apart from being white male, now white bald male. I went into the police when I was 18, and so that's obviously a job where it's all about service. Some good, some bad, naturally. But I think I recognise that I've been quite lucky along my journey. I've had a lot of elements where it's probably been sliding doors moments and the luck sort of gone in my favour. So if I can try and help other people in their journeys to make their journeys a little bit better, you know, I recognise, yeah, you've got to work hard and all that sort of stuff, but you do need an element of luck to kind of do well in various things that you do. So, yeah, can I kind of share a bit of that luck, I guess?
Pay it forward. You've obviously got to a point in your life where you seem quite grateful and content in life, so now it's a case of that feeling. Okay, so you alluded to it there. 9 years in the police force, is that correct?
Yeah. So 9 and a bit years in the police, sort of just shy of 10 years. Various roles, did 999 response, did some covert work, and then sort of latterly before I left was doing sort of serious crime investigation, mainly around fraud stuff. Varied in that. Enjoyed it generally. Maybe rose-tinted glasses, I did, maybe. I liked the camaraderie. The job itself was kind of annoying at times. No one really likes you. The public don't like you. The bad guys don't like you. That's fair enough, though. but then the system, you're kind of fighting against the system all the time. You do a good job, or a good job in inverted commas, goes to court. The court isn't perhaps as robust as it could be. The person gets away with it, and then the client or the member of public's pissed off at the police and so on and so on. So it was one of those jobs where I think if I didn't leave when I did, it probably would have changed me for the worse. And it probably did, even in that time I was there, change me for the worse. So I'm glad I kind of escaped when I did in that sense.
And it kind of goes back to that sliding doors moment. So you leave the police force, and am I right in thinking you became a lawyer?
Yeah, that seemed like a good idea at the time. And the logic here is sound, right? Scunthorpe is a stereotypical, you know, steelworking town. I grew up thinking it was pretty much like the happy family pack of cards. So do you want to be a butcher, a policeman, a postman, a doctor? Yeah, that sort of thing. So I picked policeman. And then when I was in the police, I obviously joined really young, 18, hadn't gone to university, and probably had a very naive view of the world in terms of what job opportunities there were. And, you know, really, I'm a creative at heart. That's my sort of thing. I'm I won't say good at, but I enjoy. And I probably would have been way more suited to something like a copywriter or in marketing or something like that. But I didn't know that at the time. And so for me, a logical next step from being in the police was to go into becoming a lawyer. And obviously from a semi-sheltered background, probably thought that that was going to fulfill me. The sort of the idea of glass offices, obviously well paid, walking around in a suit like a tosser. Probably thought that would be cool. And then it wasn't really until I got there and I was like, oh shit, this is wank and I hate it and I don't like the job. I'd also gone from a work environment where it's very, very camaraderie driven, teamwork driven. Oh, you're late off. I'll come and help you, to law being quite insular and everyone's kind of looking out for themselves. And I found that a bit of a strange transition. So I wasn't eligible for any, undergrad loans or anything, because technically it was a postgrad course, because I kind of blagged my credentials to go straight into a postgrad course. But it meant that I got myself into 20 grand of personal debt to do it. And I was like, shit, I fucking hate this job now. And you have to, when you first kind of get a job, you get a job as a trainee. So listen, you have to do 2 years as a trainee. So I was like, I have to do those 2 years. Otherwise, I really have like dropped a bollocks. I've been studying really hard. I've got in 20 grand of debt. So I've got to, see this through. So yeah, that's what I did. I got the 2 years under my belt. And then that was probably another sliding doors moment for me, really, because it was the point I went from, I think I was on 25 grand as a trainee, but when I qualified, it bumped up to 40. So for me, from a lad from Scunny, I was like, oh, 40 grand, decent, that's a decent wage. But I knew if I became reliant on that, I was locked in, because of what I would have done, guaranteed, I'd have mortgaged up to the 40 grand hilt, and then I'd have been locked in and never been able to move on. So I decided, along with the support of my missus, like, if I'm going to make the jump, I've got to do it now. Because if we get 3 or 4 months worth of that wage, I'm never, ever making the jump. So that's what sort of triggered it. So it was a bit, probably not a sliding doors moment as such, but definitely a moment to reflect on, what do I want to do? And is this the right time to do it, I guess.
So talk me through it. So you're early 30s, you're in a job, you're thinking, I could do this and I could be quite like happy with the money, but there's a lot of risk of, would I be happy? So was there like one of those moments that happened where you're like, I'm going to do this? How did we get from well-paid lawyer to, I'm going to go to my bedroom, I'm going to take a risk and let's see if it pans out?
I think it had been bubbling quite a long time, probably literally not day one of sitting down as in the law firm, but I think quite early on I was thinking, do I really want to do this forever? And started talking to my wife around, what could I do? What's in my skill set? So even leading up to that decision point, it probably was like almost like 2 years in the making of, probably fanciful at the start as well, truthfully, like, I could, oh, if I ever, could I ever, you know what it's like when people think about starting a business, it all feels a bit make-believe and like fanciful, like it's never going to happen. So you kind of just joke about it. So we kind of joked about it when we used to go away on holiday, we'd spend time like doing business plans for shit ideas. We had one, it was going to be called File App, really catchy name, fashion lifestyle app. And the idea was that you could take a picture and it would, you'd get feedback on the clothes you're wearing or some shit. I don't know. It was a crap idea. But like, my point is kind of coming up with different ideas, as you probably do when you're semi-entrepreneurial. Most of them are shit. But yeah, I think that thought process probably took a couple of years. And when you enter into that thought process that you could eventually leave, you're probably a little bit more open to what opportunities you might see in the workplace. So for me at the time, I was in a commercial litigation department and we were using investigation companies for corporate investigation work. And I was looking at what they were getting paid and thinking like, fucking hell, I could do that with my hands tied behind my back, given my background, like piece of piss work, not mega money by any stretch, but my logic, I suppose, was, well, I only need to replace my 25 grand wage. So how can I do that? I'm not one of these entrepreneurial types. I don't even really like, probably refer to myself as an entrepreneur, to be honest. I think I pulled a face when you said that in the intro, actually.
Sorry.
No, don't worry. It's just, yeah, I don't know. It's just like a bit cringe when it's about you, isn't it? But
yeah.
I think, but when you've got a mindset of, what I was saying, I'm not one of those, I think, who's like, I'm going to sell a business or anything like that. Genuinely, my first step out of employment was, I just want to replace my wage. And the rest of it has been very, very organic. It's not been particularly contrived in terms of what we've been trying to achieve. It's just been like one foot in front of the other. Where can we get to? And that's probably been a nice way of doing it, I think, in a way. I sort of later, and we'll probably come on to this, but I later joined an accelerator program where someone famously said in front of the sort of crowd that was there, which made me want to be sick down myself, was, I'm not a billionaire wannabe. I'm a billionaire gonna be. It's awful, isn't it? And I was, for me, I'm like, oh, fucking hell, I just want to make 25 grand a year, please. And just be my own boss. That would have done me. I think that's sort of how that thought process came about.
I like it. You weren't, you just wanted to make some money and be your own boss. You weren't a entrepreneur, as they call it.
No, God, no. Okay. I genuinely just wanted to, free myself, to give myself that freedom, because I think, and still now believe, happiness isn't money orientated. I think it's freedom orientated. But unfortunately, that freedom often requires money.
Yeah, that is a very similar story to Zach, who set up we Have a Meeting. He was ringing people, and I think he'd listened to Benjamin Dennehy on a podcast and said something like, if you're doing this kind of job, this sales job, this prospecting job for somebody else, and you're working from home during the pandemic and nobody's breathing over your neck, like, and you can still do it, you should just be doing it for yourself. And it's like, and it's that same logic of like, oh, I'll just be self-employed, it's easier. And then all of a sudden you fall into this realm of business, and you're like, oh shit, there's employees now. So
it's not as easy as I thought it was.
No, going. And then you're like, oh shit, I've got to be a boss, I've got to be a leader, all of the So let's, I guess, for the sales people that are listening to the podcast, they'd probably be keen. So day one, you start, where was your business coming from? Was it networking? Was it coming from hard cold prospecting?
Really good question, and probably there's kind of like two answers to this, because when I first left law, the business originally was doing corporate investigation work for law firms, but then it pivoted into the business that I eventually sold, which was completely different, which was an online SaaS business in cybersecurity, which I'd never done before. I just sort of, blagged again, really. So if I rewind then to the initial business that I started, that was very much traditional kind of networking. I had a bit of a network, but I'd only been a lawyer for 2 years, and not even a lawyer, I was a trainee. So my network was actually pretty ropey. But I kind of, my USP was always going to be, private investigations, a bit of a sort of wanky industry. I'm trying to add credibility because I'm a former copper and a qualified lawyer, which was kind of a bit of a USP in the area. So I was reaching out, doing a lot of cold outreach on LinkedIn, just to lawyers in commercial litigation departments and all that, all the stuff who would effectively use the services from someone like that. And then doing some local networking and trying to get introductions to people, really, the warm intros. But that was kind of a challenge for me, because I'd come from the public sector, where obviously you don't sell at all. And then even in the law firm, I was only a trainee for 2 years, so you just get given work to do and you just do it. So I've never been exposed to sales before, and it was kind of a bit of a baptism of fire to try and learn what I needed to learn, and learn quickly to, it was kind of eat what you kill. So it was an interesting start. And then if it helps to go on to the sort of when the other business kind of I pivoted it, really, that was, in a nutshell, it was a monthly subscription to get a new piece of training content and access to like a phishing simulation platform to help your staff about cybersecurity. So that was pure kind of going back to the roots of sales. It was we were selling a cybercrime product. I went to a multiple local cybercrime networking, or in fact, the ones that worked well for me were like the banks putting on classes about cybersecurity to business owners, and I just go along, almost, you know, sort of, I don't know, sort of Trojan horse a little bit, like, oh, I can help you with that. And that's where I got my first clients from, but they were obviously not very well paying. They were super small businesses. So I think my first client, well, I don't think it was my first client for that, the SaaS business, was 15 quid a month. So not exactly changing my life, but it gave me that confidence. And you'll know this from everything that you do, is like the first time you get a sale for something that you've just dreamt up in your head, the game changes. Like, that's what opened my mind up. Particularly, it did when I did the first one, when I was selling my time. But when I sold that first bit of training that I knew I could then sell 100 more times, but I've already built it, that's probably when my brain really kind of woke up, like, fuck, there's actually proper money to be made here.
There's potential. Okay. And then... Yeah. Then how did it snowball? How did it grow? Like, what were some of the? I'm always keen to. I won't call you an entrepreneur again, Eddie. But I'm always keen to like really like get under the skin of people like yourself to understand like how, what were you doing? Like, what was the journey? Yeah, I guess like why did it? How? So you're here. You've sold a subscription for £15. Fast forward 4 or 5 years, you're selling the company for multi-million. What is happening in between that sandwich?
A lot. So it started out very, very organic. So we had, obviously, I was doing a lot of face-to-face stuff. And then I knew to kind of scale it, we had to do things that were going to scale from a sales and marketing perspective. What I did fairly early was I read the predictable revenue book. I've forgotten the fucking name of it now. It's like the classic kind of go-to one that everyone reads. It's like ancient now. And it's basically about cold emailing and cold calling and setting up your funnel. The predictable revenue model, I think that's what it's called. And again, I just hadn't got a clue what a fucking CRM was. I didn't know what email marketing was, and I just slowly implemented it. And I think I was guilty, as most people are, like I was trying to do everything straight away and too fast. But again, someone giving me some really good advice was like, it does just take time. I also did the other classic mistake. I'd managed to pitch to get some work for quite a big charity to do some custom training for them. It wasn't what I wanted us to be doing, because we were trying to build the scalable thing, but it was chunky enough to go, actually, I've got a confidence now to take on an office and a first hire. But I did the classic thing that everyone always does when they try and do the first hire, and I hired a business, business development rep or business development manager, thinking I'd just hire someone, they do the sales for me. And quite quickly, that didn't work out. Thankfully, though, she was amazing and hyper skilled, and I pivoted it basically. So she took on the stuff that I was wasting my time on, or not wasting my time on, but I was taking up a lot of my time, and then it freed me up to focus on the sales, because naturally I had more kind of drive and want and need to do that, and probably turned out I was quite good at eventually once I'd sort of crafted it a little bit. So it was a real mix of cold outreach, networking. It's the classic, like, there's not one thing that ever works, is it, right? It's a multitude of things, and it's consistency, and it's also the boring shit that gets you the sale. Everyone looks for the shortcut, and there isn't one. It's doing the nasty stuff sometimes, and that could be cold emailing people, it can be cold calling people, it can get a knock back, but you only need that one to change things. Part of our training was GDPR. This was when GDPR was just kicking off and everyone gave a shit about it. Obviously, no one cares that much about it. But that had twofold effect for us. On the one hand, it was a negative for us, because we were cold emailing people about GDPR training, saying, hey, you should buy some GDPR training, even though we're just blatantly disregarding GDPR. But on the flip side, it gave us then an opportunity to tap into paid advertising, and really did work for us quite well. So when we sort of started to scale, it was a mixture between, I guess, my network having developed, but also we were able to start putting some decent and proper money into paid ads. And again, it's that classic thing. People say, well, would paid ads work for me? It's like, well, you don't know until you try it, and it won't always work. And there's 101 variables. I think for us, though, we got, again, it was right place, right time. We were just at the point where GDPR was kicking off. People were searching for either GDPR training or security awareness training or cybersecurity training that we were providing. And we were quite good in the marketplace compared to what was there, because as most people who have ever done any sort of anti-money laundering training or other online training provided by an employer, they're always dog shit. And we just made ours not quite as dog shit. So that was kind of the market conditions in our favor, really, I think. So that's where the element of luck comes in. You can work hard, you can have talent, but sometimes you do still need the luck, and I think we had that there.
Yeah, if you do the right things consistently with the right amount of luck, it's going to take off. Okay. And I kind of know this from my time, but and other people that I speak to, there are times in a business owner's journey where it gets quite tricky or it gets quite difficult. Do you have anything anecdotally where times have been difficult and what you've kind of, mindset's a bit of a wanky phrase, but what you've done to overcome those situations?
Good question. Have I got, I think the constant drain is one. Like, I don't think I'd prepared myself enough for that when I first started the business. Like, it is a slog, and we sort of touched on it earlier. You become a marketer, an accountant, a salesperson, the cleaner, and it's a slog. And then you've got to manage your home life as well, and you've just had a new baby. Throw that into the mix. It's stressful. It's tough. I think the bits I found hard were sometimes feeling like I was never doing enough, probably. And that is such a crippling mindset to get into, almost, because you become entrapped in this, oh, I'm not doing enough and the business isn't growing fast enough and I've got to be doing more, but then you're not getting any rest time. And then when you are at work, you're not being very productive. I remember very, very vividly, you know, saying to my wife, oh, I've got to work this weekend. And then I'd sit in the attic of my, you know, house where I sort of had a makeshift office, and I'd just fucking do nothing. And not intentionally, I wasn't sat there like wanking or anything, but I was just sat there just not being productive. I just was like, yeah. I know I've got a million and one things to do. I don't know what to do or where to get started. It's the classic, you know, too many things to do and you just don't do any of them. So I think that was an ongoing battle, and probably still is. I probably still suffer from that now. I think that's just human nature, right? But I think other challenges were sometimes when you've just worked really hard, and you maybe, like in one instance, we took on a new hire. I'm kind of like a person, I'll give you all my trust, and then if you break it, then you can fuck it off, basically. But I'll give you all first. And so this was a guy who was studying cybersecurity part time. He was doing that on a Thursday, Friday morning. We were hiring for a cybersecurity sales role. It was when we were a bit more established. We had like sort of 6-7 employees at this point. And obviously it wasn't a crazily well-paid job, but it was decent enough. And I said, look, tell you what, in complete recognition of the fact you're studying something that's hyper-relevant, it's going to be super useful to us, I'll just pay you full time. So even though you're going to be missing 2 mornings of the week, we'll just pay full time. Like, that's cool, right? So I did that. And then on the first day, he was like half an hour late. On the second day, he took 2 hours for lunch and left early when I was out of the office. On the third day, he rang in sick. On the fourth day, he then gave me a doctor's note, even though I didn't ask for one. On the fifth day, he gave me his wife's doctor's note, even though I didn't ask for one. And I was like, come on. Then obviously he had to go through the HR thing. When he came back, let him go. And then he like sent me this really abusive email about how much of a wanker I was. And I was like, I don't get it. Like, I've given you an opportunity that you're not going to get somewhere else, but you take it really personally because it's your business. You're trying to do right by people. Not always, not all people do. I appreciate it, and I'm sure I'm flawed in many ways, but I genuinely tried to do the best I could for him. And then that's how you get treated. And sometimes you get a little bit let down by people, I think. But having said that, that's like a really negative experience. But I should say, like, the rest of my staff, I was blessed, like had some amazing staff, like from day one, all of them were class. And, you know, good friends with them now. So there's flip side. You make some amazing, sort of friendships through it. And again, just try and do right by people if you can, I think.
I think that's a great example. I think people are brilliant, but also people can be a pain in the ass, as we know. Yeah. So it depends. Okay, cool. So you sell the business in this deal. We don't need to go too much into the deal, but I'm always keen of like exploring that phase after the deal. So I don't know what yours looked like, if it was a management buyout or whatever, but once it was done and the money was in the account, what was that feeling?
It really hard to describe, to be honest. Oh, it's not that it's underwhelming, but you're kind of like, so the deal for me was, I had to do an earn out. I had to do 2 hours with the 2 hours. Fucking hell, I wish 2 years, 2 years as an earn, 2 hours earn out. That'd be fucking class. Which was kind of ironic for me because I got a very, very good deal. And after we negotiated the deal, I'd been quite like ballsy in the negotiation, and they were due to like fly out on a Monday morning, but we hadn't quite finalized the price. And I'd said, well, if you're not going to at least show me the numbers before you come, you may as well not bother getting on the plane. Kind of politely, but a little bit like, And I remember like looking back now, you're thinking, you fucking idiot, what were you doing? But so I got a really good deal. And then afterwards, sort of after we agreed the price, they then negotiated my like package, like salary, car, that sort of thing. And I said to my wife, I was like, fucking hell, if they'd just offered me the salary and the car first, I'd have probably taken half of what they offered me. That was kind of weird. It's kind of weird because obviously you're selling something that you've built up. I hadn't been doing it that long. It was a very, very quick exit, and it's quite unusual. So it was like 3.5 years. I'm trying to think what the day we completed the documents, I went into the lawyers in town. It was mid COVID. So the city centre of Manchester was completely dead. I mean, completely, not a single soul. Went into the solicitor's office, which is one of the big ones, would have normally been absolutely booming. There was me and him, and that was it. So it was like kind of like a surreal moment, probably. Mm. But probably it would have been surreal anyway, right? But amplified by being in the city centre of Manchester, where there wasn't a single soul. It was probably a mixture of happiness, relief. Yeah, probably they were the overriding ones. And probably just, you know, it'd been quite a long few months in negotiation. And at any point, they could have just pulled the rug, particularly like COVID kicking off at the time. So I was probably, relieved probably more than anything, I'd say. But yeah, it was interesting. My mum always sort of was worried that I'd regret it. She was like, oh, but it's your baby. And I was like, it's not really. Like, for me, business was always about, you know, first off, trying to make that replacement wage. And it's never been about, or that hadn't been about, creating something that I wanted to own forever. It was like an opportunity that I saw. And then, quite frankly, got an offer I couldn't refuse. And that made the decision really easy for me. So yeah, I think probably relief probably was the big
relief.
Yeah, I think
okay.
So.
Okay. And then obviously you're still within the business doing bits. When does the brain start ticking again? Obviously you've got a few different things on the go now, other businesses. When did the brain start thinking, you know what, I'm getting excited? We know that feeling when you come up with, I woke up at 5 a.m. in the morning once, woke my partner up. I said, I've had this idea. It's, oh my God, I'm going to, it's awful. So I'll tell you, it was called the manifestation station. It was box that would wake you up in the morning and give positive affirmations. And I was like, this will be, and she was like, go back to sleep and please stop waking me up with these stupid ideas. But when did the brain start ticking again? When you was like, you know what? I want to, now I've done it, I want to be an accountability coach. I want to set up this. I want to do this.
So I was given some really, really good advice when I sold my business that I shouldn't do anything for like 2 years. Just take the money, do the earn out, and just don't do anything. So I didn't listen to that. And honestly, I kind of wish I had, in a way, because I think I did some things that I wouldn't do now. So when I first, well, I say it's easy with hindsight, and also probably slightly warped view, right? So I probably very quickly, like literally immediately, was like, right, what else can I be doing? I've now got a bit of capital to do stuff that I couldn't do before. So I originally built GoFounder out as a founder community. And the idea was, it's just free, everyone can join. Loads of, like, I spent quite a lot of money and a lot of time building all this free resource on how to start a business. Because I was feeling very, I can't say the word, philanthropic.
Yeah, I know the one. I can't say it either. Yeah.
And I was feeling like that. But I truthfully, I spent quite a bit of money on it, quite a lot of time on it, and I didn't really think it through properly. I didn't really think about long term, what's the point of it? Like, who do I even want to use it? I did the classic thing you should never do when you're starting a business, which is build it and think they will come. And it did get quite a lot of use when it first launched, but then I was getting busier still, obviously, with the old place, and starting other things off as well at the same time. So I didn't give it my full attention, and therefore it didn't really do as well as I think it could have done. And I never really quite found the true direction of it. However, what it did do is I made some fantastic connections with early stage founders, which probably has helped me now. You know, I've got a good network of founders in that sense, and probably like earned quite a bit of goodwill from it, I think. And then it did eventually then pivot us into what we're doing now, which is accountability coaching. So the ultimate kind of cause was all these people were coming to the platform to start a business, or the early stages of starting a business, you know, maybe sort of revenue generating, but not much, but they were just going off on a tangent doing shit they shouldn't be doing, like changing the logo for the ninth time, even though they've only, you know, got a grand coming in a month. So the idea was, it was always to try and set that up to keep people on track and focus on the things that matter most, you know, follow the money. So it eventually pivoted into that. So it's hard, isn't it? Like, I look back and go, oh, you know, I shouldn't have done that, but then we won't be where we are now without doing it.
Yeah.
And that's true of my whole career, and I think everyone, you know, you're never going to get to where you are without the bit before it, are you? So
of course. So if I sit down with you, so I hire you now, Eddie, you're my accountability coach. How do we start? What do you do? Because it sounds like, obviously, I can do that. I can get distracted very easily, and then I'm editing a YouTube video, and I'm like, why have I spent the last 45 minutes doing this? I should be doing something else. So how do you, what is important when making other people accountable?
So, well, we've got a couple of coaches, Ben and Dale, who do lead the accountability sessions. But ultimately, it's about just holding people's feet to the coals a little bit. So the premise is dead simple, and it's so simple, but it just works. So the idea is, you jump on a call, it's 20 minutes long, once a week, and in that call, we'll review what you've done the previous week, but identify what is the five highest impact tasks that's going to really move the needle for your business this week. And if we can, let's diarize them, get them in there, or at least you'll have that on a bit of a dashboard so you can come back to it at any point. Mm-hmm. So next time you sit down at your desk and you're like, oh, fuck, what shall I do now? You don't. You go straight to that list, because they're the stuff you have to get done. And then we basically follow up in between, like WhatsApp and calls and things like that, to say, like, have you done it yet? You do that today. Why has it not been done? It's kind of like, in a nice way, having a boss. So the thing I've struggled most with as a founder, and I still do, is when you had a boss, it was easy because you're accountable, right? But when you're your own boss, there's no one holding you accountable. And on top of that, you're also lonely. You're discussing ideas in isolation. You've got no one to bounce it off. So really, the reason why we kept it under the sort of branding and everything of GoFounder was partly because of the name and the meaning behind it. GoFounder, co-founder, you know, we can help you push on it. It's not that they are a co-founder, but there's almost that element of someone you trust who you can talk to about things, and they'll give you an opinion. I mean, the job isn't to be a business coach. The job is to hold you accountable, but they'll obviously stop you walking off a cliff, or listen to your problems, or, you know, bounce some ideas around as well. So it just gives people someone else, probably head to peck rather than the partner, or if they haven't got a partner, you know, it's just someone to really bounce the ideas off. And I'll be honest, I was skeptical when we first launched it. Ben and I'd hired Ben to come into the team. I used to work with Ben. I hired him to come and help me kind of get hold of GoFounder and decide what to do with it. And then we did a bit of research and we found what we thought would work, and we trialed it. And I, if I'm being brutally honest, thought it's probably not going to work. I don't really like business coaching per se. Not that business coaching is bad, but I just think it's one of those industries that unfortunately has been tainted by a lot of bad ones. And yeah, I probably was very skeptical, but then we did it and the results have sort of spoken for themselves, and like people having insane productivity just by having someone to hold them accountable in a very simple way. So yeah, it's been quite an eye opener really. And like, you know, it even helps me now doing what I'm doing, because I am the worst for getting distracted.
I think I've seen some of your clients past or present that sing its praises of having that accountability. And I think it's one of those things. Like, one of the big pieces of advice I give when I do sales training is like, look at your diary. What are the revenue driving tasks? And yeah, and it's, it might be different with founders, because there might be like product, or well, we need this product. But like you say, if you're going over the logo or you're spending 3 days coming up with a tagline, nobody gives a shit. Exactly. Like paralysis by analysis.
Exactly. And even that example you just give, like the product, yeah, maybe you do need to make the product better, but it's fucking irrelevant if you're not selling it. So it is, you know, sales training is going to be key, right? Because you've got to fucking sell. Like, that's all that matters. Everyone gets way too caught up in the sort of shiny bits of entrepreneurship, and, you know, the social media side of it, really, when actually all that fucking matters is you sell and you make money, you make a profit. We see it all the time on LinkedIn, the dickheads who, oh, I turn over $1 billion. Yeah, but you fucking lost 2 million quid last year.
Yeah.
So stop talking out your ass and go make some money.
We know the LinkedIn lunatics. Yeah. Okay. So then you've got that, you're smashing it. And then where does the commerce business come in? Where does the sleepwear business come in?
So again, it was, I had my daughter, my first daughter, I'd sold the business. No, I hadn't sold the business. My daughter was still very young when I sold the business. So she was born in October, I sold in the May. And just, it was kind of born out of frustration, really. You'll have had this as a new dad. Baby grows with the poppers, middle of the night, you pop them up, you get to the last one, it's the wrong fucking one, you've done it wrong, you've got to start again. So a bit of sleep deprivation. And also, we were kind of only getting clothes from Sainsbury's or Mamas and Papas or whatever it might be, but there wasn't really anywhere I could find at the time like properly sustainable. So I spoke to my mate who had a product-based business at the time that had struggled because of COVID. And I just said, like, I think I've got this idea where I think if we can make a product sustainable, implement these features like a two-way zip so you get away with the poppers so you can actually just zip it and it's a lot cleaner, then I think it's a goer. But obviously entered that very naively, having never done consumer stuff before or having had anything manufactured before. So we sort of got that up and running. We put obviously quite a bit of our own money into it. We then did like an early pre-seed raise a little bit ago now for about 500K. And then we're just raising again at the minute to try and take it to the next level. We've sort of hit run rates of a million, which is quite a lot of baby grows to sell. And like the product is good now. We've, you know, got that absolutely nailed. But the bit that's been really interesting is how you go from being like an entry level player to that next step up. And to do that, we need the money to have inventory, because we've had issues with like, you know, stock coming in time, manufacturing Turkey had the big earthquake, et cetera, et cetera. So really we've been trying to operate like a just in time, also like literally the products land and we sell it the next day kind of thing, but it's been hard work. So, yeah, really excited, like big growth plans for that ahead. But it's not without challenges, as every business is. Like GoFounder, for example, is really small turnover wise compared to GroGro's, as an example. But yeah, it's just, I think for me, I've always enjoyed opportunities and, you know, seeing what there is out there and the chance to learn. And then you start to see these businesses, I look at GoFund and go, God, that could be £1 million turnover business easily. We just need the reach, right? And then grows. We've got to the £1 million run rate and we're like, crap, we could get this to 10 million for sure. We could become the future Mothercare who would turn over 700 million in their prime. But to get there, you're going to have to work hard. You're going to need the talent, but you're still going to have a little bit of luck to get there still. And that's the bit I'm pretty realistic about, I think.
I feel like we could have an episode on its own just to talk about commerce, because I feel like branding and all those things. Oh. I've got to ask you while I've still got you, Eddie. If you were my mate and we were in the pub and you turned to me and said, I've had this idea, I'm going to buy an 18th century chapel, I'm going to convert it, I'm going to stick a... I'd look at you and I'd say something like, you're fucking mental, but that's brilliant. How and why?
Genuinely, I had the capital from the sale of the business, needed... The bit I didn't realize when I sold a business was there is no manual or playbook for what you do after. So obviously I got a nice chunk of money landing in my bank and I was like, fuck, what the fuck do I do with that? You know, I could invest it in stocks and shares. I could put it in an ISA, all that sort of usual stuff. I'm like, well, yeah, but how do I actually make proper money, right? So I thought, well, if I basically create an investment that also creates an income, that would be a good idea. And I'd always said for years and years and years, having commuted into the city centre, worked in most of the Manchester co-working spaces, that's great. They're all in the city centre, but there's nothing good out of town. So why can't we have a really good sort of city centre vibe co-working space in the suburbs? And so I said to my missus, I was like, if I find the right building in the right location, I'm just going to fucking go for it. And obviously I had a bit of capital to do that with. So I was scrolling on Rightmove one day, the commercial Rightmove, and a church came up for sale, this one I'm sat in now. And churches are relatively cost effective to buy. They are, however, not cost effective to do up. So entered it with a heavy dose of kind of naivety, really. Sort of came to see it, sort of rang my missus and said, I think I've just bought an 18th century chapel. and then, you know, enlisted the help of people who I kind of met along my journey, really. So like the building contractor who's absolutely fucking smashed it out of the park. He's amazing. If anyone needs a builder, he is the man. He'd just done some relatively small time work at my house. And I said to him, I was like, come and have a look at this with me. You could fucking do this. And he came and had a look at me, thought I was absolutely bonkers. So enlisted him, Andy, top lad. Then I enlisted Lauren, interior designer, who joined GoFounder. So again, it's interesting how the sort of background came into play. And basically enlisted all these different people to kind of come in and just help me do it. And I can't really take any credit, mate. Like, the interior designer designed it. The builder built it. I just sort of had the stupid idea to start with. But it's amazing. Like, I'm absolutely over the moon with it. Obviously, it's a business. We've still got to do the right things. We've still got private offices to let on the ground floor. We've got some co-working space upstairs. We've got the content studio. But it is like the building is amazing. I now need to make the business amazing. And it'll come in time, I'm sure, because the early interest signs are all there. But the thing is, it's still... The thing you've got to still remember, it's still a business, and I've got to make it work and make it a sustainable business. And that's sometimes the bit when you have a sale like I did, you can lose sight of that a little bit. And I think I did for a year or two. And then now I'm coming out the other end, I've got a bit more focus and a bit more drive again. Whereas I definitely didn't really have that for a couple of years, I don't think.
I love it. And I think one of the themes that rang through this conversation, Eddie, is you, even when you are setting up businesses, even if it sounds like you're a bit crazy and you've just gone and bought an old chapel, you are thinking about what problem you actually solve. Like, it's not just on a whim. Like, you've got that kind of straight line founder thought process of like, what, I'm not just going to build it and hope they come. What am I building here? What am I solving?
Yeah, and that is, you know, I see it time and time again in the sort of few years since, well, 3 years and a bit now since selling my business, I've like had countless calls, coffees, whatever, with founders or wannabe founders. And yeah, that is the thing. they've got to be laser focused on. Are they actually solving a problem that is a real problem that other people have, or is it just something I've made up in the head? Like, for example, GoFounder, when I first did that, I'd built something that I thought people needed, but they didn't really, because it was going to be too hard for them to use and so on and so on. So you've got to keep laser focused with that at all times, or you drop the ball.
Amazing. Eddie, thank you so much for joining us. Can I hit you with some quick fire questions? I always like to
go for it.
Pick people's brains and see. Yeah, if you can't think of anything, that's fine. What's the best nonfiction book that an entrepreneur should read?
Well, it's the old one that I mentioned earlier in the podcast, The Predictable Revenue Model. It would be very dated now, but I still think there's probably elements of encouraging you to test, trial, and just test and learn. Like, that's the ultimate thing for sales and marketing, in my opinion, is you don't know unless you try it, but try it without killing yourself. It needs to be something that a mistake that you can live through. But unless you try these things, you don't necessarily know the outcome.
Good. Your favorite quote?
Oh, I'm not very good with quotes.
You can make it up if you want.
Well, probably some advice that still is quite simple but rings true was a mate. Well, two things actually. Was the same person actually. It was on the accelerator program I joined, but it was like, follow the money. Like, that is all that matters. That's the most important thing. Follow the money. And the other one was, it takes time. I think all founders want to be at the peak of the mountain straight away, but the journey takes time, and you've got to be careful to enjoy the journey. One little tip I would give is make sure you set some goals, write it down, scrap a paper with some rewards that you're going to get to. I only did this a little bit later after I'd started, but just daft shit like first US customer, go and have a fucking TGI Fridays or whatever it might be, or what, you know, little milestones that you can celebrate, because otherwise most founders, myself included, you never stop and celebrate. You just keep going, keep going, keep going. And that's not fair on you, but it's often not fair on the people you're dragging along the journey with you, like your wife or your partner or whatever it might be.
I like that. I think one of the people that don't get enough shout outs during the business conversations are the partners that put up with the 5 a.m. ideas and the late nights and things like that. So no, I like that, and the goal setting. Amazing. Eddie, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. Pleasure. I know that you're not a million miles from me, so I'm going to come down for a coffee. If people want to come and work in the chapel, they want to check out your podcast studio, they want accountability, or they just want to get in touch with you, what should they do?
LinkedIn's probably the easiest place. That's where I'm on most of the time. If you're interested in the chapel, more than happy to come and give you a tour or have just even a coffee and a chat. ministryofwork.co.uk, or you can see the whole build process that we went from start to finish on Instagram. And then GoFounder, just gofounder.com, but easiest is probably just LinkedIn.
Amazing. Eddie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure, mate. No worries. Thanks a lot.